audience, we will not be moving Senate Bill 699 today. We will not be moving Senate Bill 532. We have a number of other bills that we'll get to if we have time. I think that the two bills relating to forestry, Senate Bill 1061 and House Bill 2729, will probably won't get to for about a half hour or so. So if folks are here on those bills, go have a cup of coffee or something, and I'd come back around 8:30 or so, if that's okay. Should have told you, Marvin Brown, yesterday, come in at 8:30 instead of 8. Sorry about that. I do want to open a work session on Senate Bill 245. And
what, I don't see anything.
What amendments do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're up to the dash threes right now. The dash three amendments revert this back to what was almost the original bill, except that instead of requiring Metro to do their inventory reviews once every 10 years, it requires them to do them once every 7 years. Currently, the statute requires it every 5 years.
Right. And just for the benefit of the committee, this is the one where Randy Tucker briefed us last time. John Chandler joined us and kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, well, it's probably okay. They may want to work it on the House side. But Chair would move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 245. Is there any discussion?
No,
Senator Brown. Okay. Katie, could you call the roll?
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Burgess? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice President Atkinson? Chair
Greenberg? Aye. And motion adopted, and Chair moves Senate Bill 245 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just okay. Object to the motion.
Katie, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burgess? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Atkinson? President Courtney?
Yes.
Chair Greenberg?
Aye. And motion adopted, and I will go ahead and carry that bill. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 570. If you could go ahead and discuss the bill, Matt, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the biopharmas bill that we discussed back in April. We have
Rick, would you like to come up just for a second?
We've got the dash 2 amendments right now, I believe, are the most current amendments that we're looking at.
For the record, you are.
I'm Rick North with the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility.
And could you describe for us the dash 2 amendments?
Dash 2 amendments, they clarify what the bill does not cover, herbicide-resistant crops, such as the Roundup Ready crops, it does not cover. There was a question on creeping bent grass, which is being tested and has not been approved yet for commercial use. That's herbicide resistant. This bill would not cover creeping bent grass at all. And then the second amendment, this is plant incorporated protections. These are.
Oh, excuse me, when you say the second amendment, you're referring to the dash twos?
The amendment? I'm sorry, I don't have the.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty sure he's referring to the dash twos.
No, the dash two, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the dash twos, I'm sorry. If a plant has been genetically engineered to enhance disease resistance, this bill does not cover that. It does not affect it at all.
All right, so we need the dash twos. We don't need a dash one.
That's correct.
Okay. Are there any questions for Rick about the dash twos? All right. Chair would move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 570. Is there any discussion? Katie, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Byer?
I don't know. Okay. I don't care about the dash 2s. I'll oppose the bill.
Oh, you have to vote yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
Senator Burgess? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Aye.
Yes, I mean, it's good effective.
There you go.
Aye. Motion adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 570 as amended to the Senate floor with a DPAS recommendation. Is there any discussion? Katie, can you call the roll, please?
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Brady? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
President Courtney?
Yes.
Chair Ringo?
Aye.
And motion adopted. And Senator Shields, would you like to carry that?
Yes.
Serving notice.
Okay.
Serve notice.
Okay. Could be fun.
It will be.
Thank you very much.
We're going to make this a good deal.
If you moved to the area,
if you were there, maybe you were
25. So I think it was Bill. Is Art Schlack here?
Nobody.
Is he right outside?
He filed an article last week. You go in prison article.
2258.
Oh, the Aleutian Canals.
Mr. President, we are happy to have you for this entire hearing. So get comfortable, but we don't need your votes, as far as I know, further this hearing.
So I'm done.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President.
We're always glad to have you here, sir. I'm very sincere, sir.
He's going to get represented as well.
Okay.
Why would they take you?
That's fine. Sure.
Why not?
I don't know.
We'll just hang for a minute while we.
I'm waiting for it. What bill are you on? Mr. Chair? Which bill are you on?
Well, I'm waiting to see the sign up sheets because there's a.
So, 347. We're not doing those?
Kept asking. I guess not. I thought we could.
I thought that's why he was here.
He was here for 245 and for 575.
Friday. Asking
him more. Not doing 699.
Yes.
Tomorrow's better.
Tomorrow's better.
One, this is
2256. Yeah, but they're not here yet.
Okay.
They're not here right now.
Would you like to jump ahead and do something?
The goose bill. Okay. Let's open a public hearing on two items. One is House Bill 2881, and the other is HJM 5A. These are the goose bills. And Ron Anglin, Roy Elliker. Go for it, Atkinson.
These bills seem to be quacking up the vice chair this morning over there. Is that
yes.
Right?
Yes, they do.
HJM 5 and some other Aleutian duck. Quack. That's a new hairdo for Elliker.
Yeah, he got himself a new do. I don't say yesterday.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Mr. Ron Anglin, Wildlife Commission Administrator.
That's not a fun.
And hopefully, getting to you right here, the some prepared testimony and a background sheet on Aleutian Canada geese. I also did drop a copy off at each of your offices or directly to you, so hopefully you have those in your file already, and I'll just go ahead into my prepared testimony in the sake of time. Mr. Chair, the bill as written would remove the Aleutian Canada goose from the state threatened and endangered species list. It is a very particular problem, and the reason that this is becoming in front of you is because of Representative Bob Jensen in the House at the request of the department, brought this bill forward. The issue is, frankly, that we have a migratory species currently on our state list. Was grandfathered on there in 1987 when the state list was put into effect. The species has since been delisted by the federal government. There's upwards of about 100,000 Aleutian Canada geese currently right now in the flyway because, I guess the short version is, because of a particular set of birds that nest in the Sandy Islands in the Gulf of Alaska and winter in Tillamook, in the Tillamook area. Because of that and the current statutory construction of the state ESA, the commission is unable to proceed ahead and delist the species. There is approximately 75 to 100,000 Aleutian Canada geese currently in Pacific Flyway. They're starting to cause some depredation issues for the state of Oregon and in particular some landowners in Curry County. It would certainly help the management of these species within the state if we had these birds removed from the state list. And that is the focus of the bill in front of you.
Okay. Do you have anything to add, Mr. Anglin?
Chair Ringo, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. No, I don't. I'll just be available to answer questions.
Senator Bonner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roy or Ron, doesn't the commission have the authority to remove species from the list?
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, yes, they do, and we did make an effort to remove the Aleutian from the list once it was federally delisted, and what we came up against is because there's a small subsegment of the population that winters exclusively in Oregon that is still at risk, and we cannot assure the reproductive success of that little subpopulation that we could not delist. So we did try it, and we were not able to meet the criteria as outlined within the state ESA and within statute.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Well, if we've got a problem with our list and how we get things on and off it, why don't we fix that rather than just take a specific species off it?
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, last session the department worked with a number of legislators to bring a bill forward that was a more general change to the statute, but was unsuccessful in getting that passed. And the other thing, Senator Beyer, is that because of the immediate issues with this particular bird, the fact is we do have some landowners suffering some depredation, that the bird has greatly increased even in the last couple of years from about 40,000 to maybe double that now. So because of the immediate nature of the issue with the Aleutian Canada goose, that's why we worked with Representative Jensen on this bill for this particular species.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Where is the bill this session to fix the list problem and how we get things on and off?
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, the department did not bring forward a general bill to try and fix the particular species. I think there is a bill right now in the House that would remove a number of species from the list. That's sponsored by Representative Bob Jensen again. But at this point, the department did not come forward with a bill similar to last time in view of the difficulties we had last session.
Sorry, Atkinson, go ahead.
Thanks. The subset of the Aleutian goose, that's in Summer Lake. Is that correct?
Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson, the subspecies or the kind of whatever you want to refer to, variety of birds, they nest in the Sandy Islands in the Gulf of Alaska and they winter in Tillamook area. About 200, 300 birds is what's in that subpopulation. And that's been stayed for probably the last 5 to 10 years.
That's correct. What bird species am I thinking of then in Summer Lake? Of the Aleutian geese.
And are you talking about Canada goose species, or are you talking about other
Aleutian
geese like snow geese?
Aleutian geese.
Senator Ringo, Senator Atkinson, the snow geese that come to Summer Lake come directly from the Gulf of Alaska area, the Wrangell Island. And so they are particular island nesting birds as well, and they are a particular subpopulation of overall snow geese, and maybe that's some
is that
confusion.
Not so? It's not the Aleutian geese that fly to Summer Lake?
Chair Ringo, Senator Anderson, no.
What is the health of those Lake County geese, those populations?
Chair Ringo,
Senator Atkinson, they're very healthy, and I think the subspecies you're actually referring to might be the tule goose, and it is a subspecies of snow goose that there is some concern about, and we've been working with California on some banding projects and with Pacific Flyway on that, but they're not related to the Aleutians. It's a different subspecies of geese completely.
In the mind of the department, is Summer Lake healthy?
Senator Ringo, Senator Action, yes. And let me just correct my friend, Mr. Anglin. The tule goose is a variety of white-fronted goose, not snow goose.
Right.
But that's a particular. There's been some discussion in the flyway about particular management issues on the tule goose, but it's not anywhere near being endangered or threatened in that kind of status.
So Summer Lake is healthy in the mind of the department, even though it's drying up.
Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson, if you're referring to the goose populations in the Summer Lake wildlife area, and that's a particular wintering ground for tule geese, white-fronted geese, snow geese, Canada geese, those species are all doing fine. As particular kind of water aspects of Summer Lake, since it's in the Great Basin, it's dried up over many years and been wet through many years.
Just a couple more questions. You mentioned in your testimony the Pacific Flyway Council. Does the Pacific Flyway Council think that the flyways in Lake and Klamath County are healthy?
Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson, yes, sir, I believe they do. If you're referring to the goose populations there.
I'm referring to our waterfowl in general.
Senator Ringo, Senator Atkinson, I think there's been some declines over the last... Probably.
Hold on just a second. Can we have the audience be all? I can't hear him.
Senator Atkins would like there to be a little quiet in the audience, please, so that he can hear this testimony.
Go ahead.
Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson, would you repeat the question for me?
I'm talking about, you mentioned in your testimony of the Pacific Flyway Council, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and you representing the department, and my question is about the health of waterfowl in general. Of those flyways that are in the Warners, Klamath, Tule Lake, does the department believe that they're healthy flyways?
Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson, yes, the department would believe those are. I'm not sure how you're defining healthy. There's been some years when there's been not as many waterfowl in the Summer Lake area, and then of course in the Warner Basin on wet years they're great waterfowl areas, but in dry years most of the water is not there, so the waterfowl move further down to California rather than hanging at Warner Basin to begin with. So there's a lot of movement in that Great Basin country depending on wet years and dry years, but as far as numbers of birds at Summer Lake and overall waterfowl, I believe the numbers have been stable for about the past 5 to 10 years, though not in as high numbers as been in the past, over the past decade or two.
Just one more, and then I'll let this go. Does it worry the department at all on low water years that some of those birds might not be impregnated to return through there and just will continue to skip over? Those flyways will skip over from, essentially from Canada, not flying through the valley, flying east of the Cascades and going right down to the Delta without having a rest stop in Oregon?
Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson.
I guess in some respects we're at
the mercy of the Great Basin country, because and my sense is that waterfowl migration through there through eons of time, there's been wet cycles and dry cycles. There's very little the department can do in a dry cycle in the Warner Basin when most of the lakes are all dried up, or when Summer Lake recedes in the winter. On wet cycles, what you do see is an amazing resilience and tons of waterfowl being there on a wet year. And how waterfowl know in Canada that it's wet in the Warner Basin this year and not, or not, I still don't know. But for some reason, they're very adaptable. And when the water's there, the birds are there.
Thanks.
Thank you for that explanation. We have some proposed amendments. Have you seen those?
Senator Ringo, I believe you're... Chair Ringo, you're... I think referring to, as I was shown them, some Dash 2 amendments,
right.
Amendments brought by the Wildlife Society.
Right.
Those amendments would serve the same purpose as the bill. I guess the department has no
essentially, I think it's just a matter of process in that the bill as it's written would remove the Aleutian Goose from the list. Your complaint right now is that you don't have the authority to do that. The amendments would give you the authority to do that. Presumably you would then exercise that authority and remove it from the list. So does it make any difference to you?
Chair Ringo, it makes no difference to the department at this point. We are seeking to remove the bird from the list as fast as we can. If the amendment is passed, then we will go to the commission, request they remove the bird from the list, and there's all indications that they would do that just based on population dynamics, just as soon as they have the ability to do so.
Okay, so it would lead to the same result?
Chair Ringo, in the estimation of the agency, it would lead to the same result.
Okay, thank you. While you're at the table, could you comment, please, on the House Joint Memorial 5?
Sure, go ahead.
Chairman goes, members of the committee, for the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. The department, for a lot of years, has been working with landowners here in the Willamette Valley to address an increasing cackler goose problem. This is a case where cacklers historically used to winter in California. They're now wintering almost exclusively here in Oregon and have started causing a huge amount of damage to private grasslands here in the Willamette Valley. And House Joint Memorial 5 essentially encourages the United States Congress to recognize the seriousness of the problem here in the Willamette Valley and to continue funding for the research efforts that have occurred in the past to help us institute the special seasons that we've had to haze geese off of private lands and to continue the hunting seasons that we've offered here in the Willamette Valley under the special regulations. It's compounded by the fact that we have a species of Canada goose, a dusky Canada goose that's close to being federally listed, and we have to have special harvest regulations. So the memorial, in effect, is asking Congress to continue to recognize the seriousness of the problem here in the Willamette Valley and to work with the states, and including Alaska, to help address the problem.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Byer?
Yeah. Roy, I'm still looking at the bill on page 2 and subsection 8.
Excuse me, you referring to the House Bill
2881.
Oh, okay. Yes.
And each species shall be viewed at least once every 5 years to determine whether verifiable science, scientific information exists to justify its reclassification or removal from the list according to the criteria listed under subsection 3 and 4 of the section. And I'm trying to figure out why it is, if you've got a healthy population of geese, why it is the commission is not able to delist with that language.
Chair Ringo, Senator Byer. In order to delist, you have to go through the backwards process that you would use for listing. In the case of the Aleutian, the legislature added them to the list in 1987. It was not an action that the commission took. To delist, what we would have to look at and what we did look at is the specific criteria that you look at the time of listing if you go through a normal process. And one of the things that you have to consider is the reproductive capability of the birds that are within the state. And with the Aleutian, you have a very difficult situation in that they do not spend year-round in Oregon. They're a transient species. They're only here for a period of time in the winter, a portion of the Aleutians. Most of those birds actually end up in Northern California at this point in time. So when we legally looked at a delisting, we had to look at the portion of the birds that spent a portion of their time in Oregon. And that portion of the population is still at risk from a reproductive standpoint. From an overall standpoint, the population is healthy when you look at all the birds within the Aleutian subspecies and the Aleutian chain. And that's why the federal government was able to delist. But Oregon has absolutely no capability to influence the reproductive rate or survival of the Smitty Island birds, and there's nothing we can do to contribute to that to ensure that that sub-subpopulation would not go away. Unfortunately, the way our statutes are written, we can't be list based on that.
Okay.
Just to be clear, the amendments we've been talking about would take care of that problem?
Chair Ringo, Senator Shields, the amendments would not take care of the problem Senator Beyer brought up, but would allow the commission to go ahead and remove the Aleutian goose from the state list.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Stephen Kafoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafoy. I'm here today representing the Wildlife Society. The Wildlife Society, the Oregon chapter thereof, is a scientific society of wildlife biologists, and we try to bring as much science and good management practices as we can to the legislature so that when they make political decisions, they're making those political decisions based on some science and some good management practices. I listened to House Bill 2881 in the House and testified, asked them not to pass the bill as it was, but to make an amendment to the bill. My concern was that listing a species or delisting a species should be a scientific decision. It should not be a political decision. Regardless of your persuasion on a particular species, I think you can imagine the havoc that could be caused by a political group saying we want to list this species or we don't want to list this species, and whichever group happened to be in power in the legislature at that time could play a lot of political games. We don't think that's good policy. The issue of whether an animal is in danger or not is not a political decision. It's not a political issue. It's a scientific issue. I made this request to the committee. Chair Smith, Patty Smith, said to me she understood the concern, appreciated the concern, but there wasn't time, and asked me if I would address this issue in the Senate. I asked Chair Smith for permission to have amendments drafted at her request. I did have amendments drafted. And so I have every indication that when this bill goes back, if it's amended, that she would like to have this move for concurrence. I don't think it's a political issue. I don't think it's a partisan issue, Mr. Chair. What the amendment dash 3 simply does is instead of instead of making this a political decision, makes it a scientific decision. It allows the Department of Fish and Wildlife, based on scientific criteria, to delist the Aleutian Canada goose. Okay, so that's my testimony.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the concern I would have is, I guess there's two of them. First, we just heard that the legislature put the Aleutian goose on the list, so to say it shouldn't be a political decision, it was a political decision to put the goose on the list in the first place. Secondly, if we just give them the authority to delist this goose, but yet they've just said they can't because scientific evidence says they can't ensure its survival, we're in the same position we are today.
Senator Ringo, Representative Beyer, you asked two questions there. Let me answer one at a time. First, we, if we'd been around at the time, would not have suggested that these species be put on the list in the first place by legislative fiat. But we're not there. That's history, and we can't undo history. That's what's happened. So at this point, it makes sense to us to give the authority to ODF&W to delist. Secondly, the question of whether they can delist with this amendment. If you look at the amendment carefully, it gives them specific criteria. And based on these criteria, we have testimony you've just heard from ODF&W. This will give them legal authority.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would argue that they said that they would work to do it as soon as possible, it's amended, but they didn't say they could get it done. They said they would work to do it. They still have to jump through all the hoops and go through public hearings, and people come in and object, and scientific people come in and object and say, no, you cannot guarantee that this species is needed to effectively influence species status or recovery. They're in the same position they are today.
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, to my knowledge, there is no one who disagrees with the intent of 2881 regardless of the process that is used to get to that goal. Everyone agrees that this list bird should be delisted. ODF and W has testified here. They've talked to me personally. I've been involved with them behind the scenes on this issue for quite some time, actually through last session. And they can do this in a very speedy process in terms of how long it would take. It takes a while before this bill gets signed by the governor. Regardless of which process you use, there would be a period of time. But I can assure you that from what I've understood, and there are no guarantees in this life under any circumstances, but from what I've heard from the department, they can take care of this issue as quickly with this amendment as they can without the amendment. That the amendment is not going to be a problem, and it's not going to be a time delaying process.
Well, this is what I'd like to do, Senator Barr, if that's okay. We have a lot on the schedule today. I'd like to close this public hearing. I'd like to get guidance from you, maybe give you a chance to talk to the department about this, and we'll make a decision on what to do on Thursday, if that's okay.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Okay. I just want to move HTM 5.
Yeah, Senator Atkins and us, if we want to move HTM 5. We've got one more witness. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tim, are you here?
Yeah, thank you.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim Bernasik, General Counsel of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify in support of HJM 5. I realize you have a very busy schedule, so I'll be very brief. You heard a little bit about the memorial from representatives from ODF and W. The importance of it is to urge Congress to either develop a compensation program for farmers in the valley who are being hurt by the increase in goose depredation problem, or fund the existing Northwest Oregon, Southwest Washington goose management plan. And the specific bird at issue here is the cackling Canada goose. It's one of seven subspecies that winters in Oregon. It traditionally went down to central California, so you know, we have a situation in the Willamette Valley that in the late 70s, early 80s, we had about 25,000 Canada geese wintering in the Willamette Valley. Most of those were duskies. Now we're to a point where we have upwards of 250,000 to 300,000 birds, primarily the cackling Canada goose. And so the depredation issues are serious. We'd love to figure out a way to get the cackling Canada geese to go back down to California where they used to be. I think that would be the ultimate resolution, because this bird is very much relied on by the Yupik Eskimos up in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in Alaska during the summertime for subsistence purposes, and they're very concerned about what has been happening lately is a tailing off of that population and maybe some restrictions that would be put in place on their ability to harvest the birds in the summer. But, of course, the growers here in the Willamette Valley have seen the numbers that we're facing increase. And so we think that HJM 5 is a good solution to urge Congress to fund this program to better manage the birds so that we have fewer depredation concerns in the Willamette Valley, and the Yupiks up in Alaska, their needs for the bird are met. So unless you have any questions, I'll...
No. Okay. Senator Shields.
Just a very quick question. As I listen to you talk, it sounds like somehow, some way, and maybe you didn't intend this, but they're stopping in Oregon rather than going on to California affects their return to Alaska. I didn't understand that.
Senator Shields, no, there's a number of reasons that people give for why the birds are stopping here. When they used to come through the valley and on down to the Central Valley in California, some theories say that the habitat in California has been changed. The staging areas in southern Oregon, the Klamath area, some of the issues Senator Atkinson raised earlier, has made that not as an effective staging area for the geese. And frankly, the cropping patterns in the Willamette Valley have changed from berries, cane berries, which aren't very good for birds to feed on, to grass seed and wheat, which just they love to feed on those crops. So there isn't an issue. The birds are coming back and forth. As far as I know, I'm not aware of any issues there. It's just what are happening with those overall numbers. We've seen a dramatic increase in the valley, but overall, the bird numbers returning in Alaska because of hunting pressures or whatever else here in the valley, have caused a tailing off of the numbers, not necessarily a steep decline as far as I know, but the rebound that they had been seeing over the years up in Alaska has tailed off, and that's raising some concern up there. And so what we really need is better management, and that's what HJM 5, should Congress respond to it, will help us with the overall management so that the needs of the Alaskans, the native Alaskans, are met, and the needs of the farmers are met as well.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on HJM 5 and also on House Bill 2881. As far as moving the bills, I'd like to move them together. Maybe we can have Goose Day on the Senate floor. And so we'll Senator Byard, ask you to figure out what you'd like to do and perhaps talk to the department on 2881, and we'll consider moving them on Thursday. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2356. Art, would you like to come in and enlighten us on this bill, please? Is there anybody else who would like to come up with our... Yeah, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And here in support of House Bill 2356 and also the -4 amendments, which I believe you should have. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2356 corrects a problem that was created by a 2003 Court of Appeals decision. And in that decision, the court determined that based on the statute, that a surveyor, when he looks at a final plat, as it is then submitted for recording, he is making a land use decision. And as such, before the surveyor can sign the final plat for recording, that notice and an opportunity to appeal a second time is required. This, low these many years, has not been a requirement at this point. So that's what House Bill 2356, as it passed the House unanimously, I believe, and is before you with some additional amendments to at least at this point correct some omissions that were created by legislative counsel at this point. What the bill does, Mr. Chair, then is clarify that the surveyor or other elected officials that are reviewing the final plat is not a land use decision or limited land use decision. Mr. Chair, the -4 amendments, let me just speak to those very briefly. The -4 amendments replace Section 1 of the bill, and in doing so, it replaces some existing language that was deleted, specifically with regard to Section 1. If you look at the -4 amendments, sub 1 little c was deleted from the bill, and this section allows the surveyor to look at plats outside urban growth boundaries. So it's extremely important that we return that to the statutes. There is also in section E or section F, excuse me, in section 1.
Now, are you referring to the -4s now? Or the
main yes, points? I'm referring to the -4s.
All right.
There is, we had language that talks about line 1, where you'll see at the end of the section it says city or county surveyor, and we are replacing the city in there, and also in line 2, where you'll see it says city or county. So we're returning to the original language of the statute. Then, Mr. Chair, on page 4 of the amendments, you'll see Section 3. Section 3 just clarifies that The bill will apply to plats that are submitted after the effective date of the 2005 Act. We would note that the bill already contains an emergency clause, so it will be effective when the governor, assuming it's passed, when the governor signs the bill. Finally, Mr. Chair, let me just say that this is a problem that affects not only local government but also the development community. And to that effect, Mr. Chair, I would note for you that the Association of Oregon County, League of Oregon Cities, Clackamas County, where this case emanated from, the Oregon Home Builders Association, Oregon Realtors, Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon, the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors, all support the passage of this bill with these amendments. So, Mr. Chair, I would urge the committee to support passage of House Bill 2356 with the dash 4 amendments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for the questions. Okay. Senator Barry, all right with moving this? All right. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2356. Did you have...
I'm Hal Colvin.
I'm sorry.
Chairman Rengo. I work for Bank of Salem. We do a fair amount of financing in this area. Just here to support the bill. It's very important that we lend a certainty and predictability to the process, and this bill will allow us to do that.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Sorry to cut you off like that. We're in work session on House Bill 2356. Is there a motion concerning the dash 4 amendments?
Mr. Chair, move the dash 4.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2356. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Move the bill as amended to the floor with the due
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2356 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry that bill, please?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson says we're here to serve. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2755. Tom Gallagher, Chuck Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Professional Land Surveyors, and with me is Chuck Pearson, Clackamas County Surveyor, and he'll walk us through 2755 and the simple correction we need to the original bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Chuck Pearson, I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors and the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. Senate Bill 55 makes a number of technical and professional changes to the platting and partitioning of property in Oregon. We've created a new definition of utility easements. We're restricting the use of utility easements only in places where the utilities want the easements. We're removing an archaic concrete monument from the statutes. Some modifications to the property line adjustment process, and we're also here in support of the dash 2 amendments, which was inadvertently changed and overlooked in the House, which will now, as it's written, require that each street in a subdivision plat be named and shown on the plat. It's kind of a technical bill. I don't have a lot. I don't want to walk you through all of these technicalities on it. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
I don't have any. I got an A4 amendment.
Yeah, I see an A4 amendment as well.
That's the one.
And it's the A4 amendment is the
yes. I'm talking about. Mr. Chair, I was speaking of the A4 amendments. A4 is just a simple amendment that requires each street in a subdivision to be named and shown on the plat.
Okay. Well, committee administrator says we can't move this today because we need a conflict amendment. So we will deal with that, but let's, as long as we got the witnesses here, let's see if there are any questions from the committee.
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher again. I think it's important that all the people that were on the previous bill, the Hammer bill, take a good look at this one because they affect the same sections of the statute. And when it comes back, we'll make sure that we've not inadvertently again created the same problem we did with the Hammer bill.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on 2577. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2198. Mark, do you want to come up and see if there's anything to add? My understanding is there are no amendments.
27. Why is this? Thank you, Chair Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Mark Simmons. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Here to support the bill. The Civil Penalty Authority of the Department is critical to maintaining the integrity of Oregon's nursery products in national and international markets. So we appreciate the support of the bill today.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? We already had a hearing on this bill. Okay. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2198. Senator Atkinson.
I would move the bill.
Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2198 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Byron?
Declare potential conflict of interest as I am a licensed Christmas tree grower in the state of Oregon subject to this provision.
Senator Byron declares a potential conflict. Is there any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Atkinson, do you want to carry that bill?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is this the Christmas tree bill?
No.
Yes. Jason?
That's good. That's good. It feels like Christmas around here. They get their presents and they run out.
There's more empty chairs out there.
What's that?
Like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, it is like Groundhog Day, too. It's like Election Day.
We don't have Senator Westland here for about three different things. Is there anybody here on House Bill 2577?
That's not that important.
What? Are you here for the 2577? Do you want to just come up briefly then?
Yes.
Let's open a public hearing on 2577.
Noxious weeds.
And Representative Burley, are you here for one of the forest bills? Okay, we'll get to that in a couple minutes.
My name is Dan Hilburn. I'm the administrator of the Plant Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And just very briefly, we're in support of this bill. It does one very important thing, which is in Section 1, Subsection 1. It states that the department shall act as a primary state agency for assisting weed control districts, state agencies, and others in coordinating their noxious weed control efforts. That is something that's been missing from the statutes, and we're very glad to see it addressed. Under subsection 2 of that section, we have one interpretation that we'd like to pass along to you. It says that the department and the board shall initiate and actively pursue efforts to secure a maximum available federal and private funding for noxious weed control efforts. And we'd like to just put on the record that we're interpreting that to mean within the context of the plan that we developed some years ago, which includes lots of other functions. So we don't see ourselves as being simply grant writers for federal grants, but doing lots of weed control works and trying to optimize federal funding for those purposes. So with that, just to put that on the record, we're happy with the bill and glad to see this small piece to the noxious weed control problem in the state addressed.
What is a weed control district? Is that new?
Senator Ringo and Senator Atkinson, this weed control districts are not new, but there's more and more of them coming online. And it's where you have a regional effort, for instance, the Warner Basin. You get the landowners, which would be private and public agencies, working together, deciding which weeds to target and working together on their control. So more and more often we're getting weed control districts forming and doing good work in the state.
So we do have them in
we have some in the state, and we're expecting more to form over time.
More. So do we have to have administrative rules to govern these grassroots organizations?
Grassroots organizations.
I didn't mean that.
Senator Ringo, Senator Atkins, to my knowledge, the existing rules allow this, and we don't believe that we need additional rules.
Okay. And then lastly, why don't we coordinate with ODF&W? I know other states coordinate noxious weed problems with their fish and game departments. Why are we just exclusively doing this with ag rather than coordinating in other parts of the state where ODF&W has a larger presence than ag, where ODF&W actually has more habitat problems with noxious weeds, and where you won't have any oversight?
Yeah. Chair Ringo, Senator Atkins, we work closely with them on state lands and also with lots of federal landowners. So I think that coordination is in place. The department is where the expertise is in this state for weed control, and we've got the weed experts primarily in the Department of Ag.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. Is Scotch Broom on the list?
Chair Ringo, Senator Barr, Scotch Broom is on the state noxious weed list, except for named horticultural varieties, so that there are some horticultural varieties that are still in the nursery trade, but they're not invasive. But the regular wild type is on the list.
What are we doing to control it?
Chair Ringo, Senator Byers, the department's focus is on new weeds in the state and weeds that haven't reached their maximum distribution. So we focus where you can get the biggest bang for the buck, which are things like kudzu and distaff thistle and purple star thistle that are not widely established in the state, and we're trying to keep them from becoming widely established. For things like Scotch Broom, there's not enough money in the state budget, if we had it all, to solve that problem. And what we're doing with those kinds of weeds is working on biological control. And we have introduced recently a seed weevil that should help reduce the seed bank on Scotch Broom. We continue to look for other biological control agents.
Just a comment, I guess Scotch Broom hasn't reached its maximum, whatever you said yet, because until every square inch of the state is covered, it won't be maximum potential.
Just compete with ivy and yellow star thistle and a few others.
It'll outcompete it.
I just find it, Mr. Chair, amazing that we have passed out Senate Bill 570, and yet the department here is using biological agents to control weeds. That's just... is that because you don't want to spray? Or I mean, it's just we seem to be having two different pieces of policy coming out of this committee today. Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo and Senator Atkinson, they're really quite different issues. And we biological control is extremely important for some weeds. And it works in cases where you have weeds that aren't closely related to crops, so that you can introduce biocontrol agents that will not impact plants that are valuable. So that's it's a limited sphere of weeds that you can use biocontrol agents on, but it's an important one.
Thanks. My question is, part of this bill includes you shall report to the next legislature. Is there a fiscal associated with that?
Chair Ringo, we don't believe it's significant. We do an annual report anyway, so we will include you with a copy of that report.
You do this report anyway, so this is not requiring you to do a new report?
it'll be reported to the legislature, and that'll be new, but we do the report anyway, so we don't see it as causing significant fiscal force.
I'm trying to understand if you're going to be creating a new product because of this bill, or if this bill is just going to ask you to take this product you're already developing and make more copies of it.
Chair Rengo, that's our intent, is to we'll change the cover or something.
Thank
and
you.
Put your name on it.
Thank you very much. Well, it's a committee fine with this bill. All right. Let's close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 2577.
Move the bill.
Senator Atkins has moved House Bill 2577 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
I do.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Shields, would you like to carry this bill? It gives fertile,
there's fertile ground. I thought that Senator Atkinson wanted to do something with a grassroots approach to this bill.
With that, I would like to go to the two bills we have scheduled for us today and open a public hearing both on Senate Bill 1061 and House Bill 2729. And would ask Marvin Brown to come forward. And Marvin, if there's anybody that you'd like to have with you, that would be fine. And Senator Westland, are you here? Senator Westland, Representative Burley, are you there? You moved seats. I'm sorry, I didn't see you, Representative Wismut. Representative Wismut, do you want to join, pull up a chair, or wait till the next? It's fine with me.
You say you're doing a dual.
What's that?
You're doing a dual public hearing?
Yes, this is a dual public hearing. I'd like to start with our state forester and let you kind of introduce both of these bills, and then we'll hear from the elected officials.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry to keep you waiting.
No, I appreciate it. I'm here with a pretty distinguished group of folks. First, the members of the committee, my name is Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. I've handed out to you written testimony in support of both Senate Bill 1061 and House Bill 2729. Attached to that is a white paper that we prepared for the governor about a year ago this time. And I'd like to just make a few comments about where that came from and kind of why we support the two bills. About a year and a half ago, the governor asked us to consider a thought he had, which was to buy land and use the revenue from that to support a trust fund for higher education. The result was the white paper that you all have there. And essentially what the white paper said was that there's some conservation reasons and also some reasons in terms of community economic support that would make it a good idea for us to buy land. It says that there's certainly a perception in Oregon that there need not be any more public land, and it's going to be a challenge to get beyond that perception. And it says that we do have a track record of generating revenue for different beneficiaries, and we think we could do it.
Excuse me, Senator Atkinson, can I ask you to move out there, please? Thank you.
That we could do it in that instance. So in essence, the governor asked that we continue to work with his office to draft the bill. The result was Senate Bill 1061 that authorizes us to purchase land and create a trust fund for higher education from the revenue. I will say for the record that the state treasurer has indicated he would like to make some technical corrections to the bonding piece of that if this were to go forward, and we'll bring those in. But anyway, after we had delivered that paper to the governor and started to work on the legislative concept, we learned about a tract of land that was coming up for sale last summer called the Long Belt Tract. And the Long Belt Tract represents something that we think is going to happen with some frequency, and particularly in eastern Oregon. It was owned by a timber management company in the business of managing for timber. It had been harvested heavily to the point where it no longer had a great deal of merchantable timber on it, and they put it up for sale. They were willing to subdivide it. And so we took the thoughts that we had generated for the governor down to that part of the state and just started querying folks, you know, what is your views about doing something on this track, this Long Bell track? And the short answer was folks said, well, if it means subdividing this land and taking it out of timber production, long-term timber production, if it means taking it out of the realm of where it's open for the public for recreation, yeah, we think there should be some public entity step in and do something about that. In the end, a private company who was interested in long-term management stepped in and bought it, but it did tell me that there is local support for doing this under the right circumstances, and that's certainly what we'd propose. Senate Bill 1061 I would look on as a resort that goes after perhaps House Bill 2729 would be considered. I think it's a better option if a local community is interested in pursuing that kind of opportunity and setting it up as House Bill 2729 proposes, and I'm sure folks will cover that in more detail. We would look on the state as being more of an option of last resort after that, and certainly after private ownership had been exhausted. And I think there's a chance here to think in terms of a suite of tools that would be useful for protecting working forest in the state where this is going to happen with more frequency. And the suite of tools would include not just 2729 and 1061, but also the legacy program that you all approved earlier this year. Thank you. I'll leave it at that and see if you have any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead, Senator Westland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27. First of all, I very sincerely want to compliment my colleague, Representative Burley, for bringing forth this very innovative and creative bill to take care of an issue that I think faces all of us in Oregon, and I think has just been alluded to very articulately by the state forester. I want to emphasize just a couple of points. First of all, that with this forest authority, this bill is not mandatory for anyone. It simply provides the option of municipalities to prohibit large blocks of timberland from being subdivided into smaller, more developable parcels, therefore taking it out of their originally zoned and intended purpose, which is a sustainable supply of forest products for not only our mills but our personal consumption. I don't want to state the obvious, but once we lose these large blocks of timberland, we don't get them back. This bill is modeled after the Hospital Financing Authority Act, which provides an opportunity for local ownership and local control without any municipality owning the property or assuming any of the debt. It absolutely brings members of the community together from industry, conservation groups, sustainable managed forest advocates through local partnerships. Under this concept, the forest would be managed to provide revenue to pay for the operating expenses, debt, and taxes, and any excess revenue would go to the local community for schools and roads. Colleagues, I think this bill is brought forth and is most highlighted in its need from a situation right there in our very own community. Some of the Crown Pacific lands are on the west side of town, and they run, it's a very large tract of land that runs from Shevlin Park all the way through to and including abutting up to Tumalo Falls. There is no way our community can sustain any of the development that would go in that side, plus we would lose a very large dependable source of logs for some of the few local mills that remain. So with that, let me just close and turn it back over to you, Mr. Chair, but again with a great big compliment and thank you to Representative Burley for bringing forth this very innovative bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Ringo, and members of this committee. Thanks for hearing this bill. 2729 is a good bill and deserves your support. I appreciate Forester Brown's comments, and also, as Senator Westland said, the hard work and leadership by Senator Burley on this bill. He's the expert.
And your name for the record is?
I'm sorry. Representative Gene Wisnett, District 53.
Yeah.
It is also his anniversary, Mr. Chair.
And my wife's on airplane to see my grandson. We had a good dinner last night. Mr. Chair, currently it's too easy to chop up forest land into large parcels and sell them as potential home sites. It's happening all over our state, especially in our beloved Central Oregon. I said in the testimony on the floor, when I moved there, Aubrey Butte was green. Aubrey Butte's not green anymore. This bill will allow communities to keep large blocks of forest land intact by forming a community forest authority. The forming of the forest authority is not mandatory. It's only alternative to a community chooses to do so. These forests that are part of the authority will be sustainably managed, and the public will have access to it for recreational purposes. The Ben Bolton calls this bill a powerful tool for communities, and I agree with them this time. This is a good bill, an innovative idea, and it deserves your support, and I hope you'll listen to testimony by Representative Burley, who is the expert on this bill. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and I appreciate the comments that everybody else has made on this. As you know, the forest products industry has undergone some significant changes over the past 10 or 15 years, much of which is due to federal policies. But as a result of this, we've seen in the last several years two of the largest industrial forest landowners in eastern Oregon change hands. And as a result, much of those blocks of industrial forest land, the future of those blocks, are in question. In a report last year by the Oregon Department of Forestry entitled Land Use Change on Non-Federal Land in Eastern Oregon, they reported that since 1975 in Central Oregon, the area of low-density residential uses increased by 86% and the urban area by 137%. And the highest rates of change in the dominant land uses over the past 26 years has occurred in Central Oregon and Klamath County. Recently, as the state forester pointed out with the Longbelt Tract, we've seen some large blocks of timberland being sold to private individuals, which I have no objection to. I mean, it's private land. They can, you know, transact any way they want. But my concern as a forester is that what we're seeing are these large blocks of land. We're talking 30,000, 40,000 acre contiguous blocks of working forest land. When they're being sold to these individuals, they're being taken out of a working forest scenario. In other words, they've got other purposes for owning these lands, which, again, they're entitled to, but I'm just concerned that we're losing the land base that we have available to manage. And as Senator Westland pointed out, and I'd like to just show you, this is the Bull Springs tree farm that belonged to Crown Pacific before they went bankrupt. And I apologize, it's kind of hard to see, but the red line here is the western edge of the urban growth boundary of Bend. So you can see how close the tree farm is to the city itself. And some of these parcels in color are parcels that they've already started selling off for other purposes, conditional use permits to build a home on, for example. All of the green is federal land, Forest Service, BLM, very key winter range for mule deer. These lands, Crown has always allowed public access. There's mountain bike trails that come and go off this property onto the Forest Service and whatnot. And so this really just illustrates to me the concern that I have is that if we start splitting this thing up, and by the way, you know, this is Sisters up here on the north side of the property. So as Senator Westland pointed out, this bill is permissive. It does not mandate that anybody do anything. And it also does not result in more public ownership. The bill does, it provides for local ownership, local control. It's based on the same concept as the Hospital Financing Authority, which is in ORS Chapter 441. Municipalities don't own the property. They do not assume any of the debt. I also want to point out that this bill is not intended to solve the forest product industry's problems. I mean, we've got to deal with some federal issues. There's other things, but as the Senator pointed out, to me, this is another tool in the toolbox to help us try to maintain these large blocks of working forest as working forests. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. To me, this is it's a very interesting concept, and when I heard about it, my initial reaction was, well, this flies in the face of what a lot of people want to do in terms of not wanting to move more land into public ownership. And Representative Burley, your comment just a few minutes ago said it didn't do that. I guess it depends how we're defining public here. It certainly is moving it away from a purely private ownership. And also it strikes me as, you know, the discussion we've had, I mean, two rows back is Dave Honeycutt, who I think would tell you maybe the best use for some of this land is to subdivide it. We've had lots of discussions about farmland and forest land, and that when you talk the highest value of the land, if you let the market dictate, then probably that's what would happen. And obviously you're trying to look for long-term values in other ways. But why is this not moving more land into public ownership or public control?
Well, under this authority, if you will, you would have a private nonprofit corporation, and the Forest Authority, as with the case with the hospital authority, is a conduit for this financing, and it would be revenue bonds, not GO bonds, but revenue bonds. So you would, A, first of all, you'd have this nonprofit corporation. B, you would identify the public purposes, which according to this act is this permanent management of these lands to produce revenue. The authority would issue these revenue bonds on behalf of the nonprofit. It's the nonprofit that would own them. Excuse me. So you have, it's the same thing as if you had a corporation. I mean, if any forest products company wanted to come buy these lands, they could do so tomorrow, which would be fine, and this bill wouldn't prevent that. But what this bill does is it gives us an opportunity in the community. If we want to create a nonprofit corporation, that corporation could acquire the property using these revenue bonds. It would not be publicly owned. We would have a private nonprofit corporation. We'd manage it. We'd have to produce logs to pay off the debt and any other applicable taxes or whatever the case may be. It would be subject to all the same rules and regulations that a private landowner would have, Forest Practices Act, etc. And any excess revenues would stay locally with the municipality that created the authority.
Okay. Senator Shields?
First question, how large a block was that you just showed us?
This, according to this, it's about 31,281, but I think that number is actually a little on the low side.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair? Is there an authority... Excuse me. Is there a community forest authority like this set up in any other state that you used as an example?
It's my understanding that California has it. Washington also has it. In fact, a couple years ago, there was an attempt to do this with Weyerhaeuser and some other groups. They formed what was known as the Evergreen Trust. That was the nonprofit that was going to acquire these properties from Weyerhaeuser in what I believe was the Snoqualmie Pass area, I believe. There's actually some other folks here that were involved in that could answer that question better. So it has been tried in the past, yes.
Follow-up, if I'm not wrong, that attempt didn't work, or couldn't pull that off? Is it too big, too small? Has anybody ever done anything this size?
The Weyerhaeuser one, I believe, was of the same magnitude, and it's designed for these large blocks because, you know, if it's a small piece, you're not going to have the base to generate the revenue from. The reason the one up in Washington didn't quite go to fruition was because under the IRS code right now, because of the asset class that these things are, the nonprofit could not use tax-free revenue bonds. You can do it right now with taxable revenue bonds. We, in fact, have a bill in Congress where we're trying to change that so that this type of an asset class could utilize a tax-free revenue bond. What they were trying to do in Washington was set up for a tax-free revenue bond. They couldn't get the law changed in Congress, and that's why that deal didn't work out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Byer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't, you know, been hauling you fun and taking on this today. But I guess I'll start with...
Senator Byer, just to let you know, we have a couple of folks that are also scheduled to testify that I think have a lot of the technical information as well. So you might want to save some of your questions
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll just start with some basic ones. On Senate Bill 1061, Mr. Brown, section, well, start with the whereas clauses. You state that the state-owned forests have proven to be a good investment for the state, producing funding for schools and a strong financial return on investment. Could you tell us the return on the investment of the LA State Forest to the Common School Fund?
Senator Ringo and Senator Beyer, there's a cost-benefit study recently completed by Mason, Bruce, and Gerard that dealt with the question of what if you sold the LA State Forest, what would happen, and that provided some value information. And based on that value information, if you kind of collect the midpoint, choose the midpoint of their range of values that they projected for that, and compare that against our projected revenue for the new plan that we're preparing right now, it's about a 5% return on investment.
Thank you. Appreciate that potential future information. But can you tell me what the return on investment has been for the old state forest?
It's probably, Senator Ringo and Senator Barr, it's probably more in the 2 to 2.5 right now. But the new plan increases harvest.
Okay, I think that's even a little high if we look back in history, but we'll move on. In Section 2, the state forest may acquire by purchase, lease, exchange, gift, or otherwise real property. Does that include condemnation?
Yeah, Senator Ringo and Senator Beyer, that wasn't the intent. Now, the intent was through donation and limited to purchase and donation.
And maybe you can't answer this question, but I'd like to know if that phrase does include condemnation by someone who's more technical, I guess. Section 3, we are continuously appropriating funds through these funds set up. And in Section 8, the legislature appropriates money to pay the bonds, but we have no oversight because the funds are continuously appropriated to the state treasurer and to the university system and to the state forester. So where is the legislative oversight on this if it was to happen?
Senator Ringo and Senator Beyer, I would assume it would be as it is right now, which we still would have to have a limitation in our budget in order to be able to expend money.
Okay. Under Section 3, the state treasurer uses the funds to provide financial aid for residents of the state who attend only universities in the Oregon University system. Why not community colleges or private schools?
Senator Ringo and Senator Barr, I couldn't give you a good answer on that. If that's an adjustment that needs to be made, we can certainly deal with it.
Okay. In Section 8, where we talk about the financing, would these be considered junk bonds because they do have no backing?
Well, Senator Ringo and Senator Barr, I don't know what the technical term for junk bonds implies. I presume that we issue bonds to do a lot of different things now, and it would be under a similar authority to do that. I don't think we would go into any proposal without a good business plan that shows the ability to pay those bonds back. But there is
no backing by the state of Oregon, according to the way I read the bill.
That could be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions on 2729, I guess, for either Representative Miller or Senator Westman. And again, maybe you guys aren't the technical ones to answer some of these questions, but under Section 2 of the bill, we talk about issuing revenue bonds or other obligations. What are other obligations?
You're right, I'm not the technical one to answer the question.
Okay.
Yes.
Senator Beyer, you're looking at Senate Bill 1061?
No, now I'm on 2729, right. Mr. Chair. I skipped wheels there or vehicles there. Section 5 of the bill, we talk about who's going to run the Community Forest Authority, and you talk about a majority of the directors present and voting is sufficient for passing of a motion. So under that scenario, let me get, am I reading this correctly to say that if it's an 11-member board, six would have to be present to be a, considered a quorum, but yet only four of those six would have to vote in affirmative to pass a motion? I'm looking at line 35 on page 2 of the bill.
I would have to take a closer look at it. Senator Ringo, Senator Beyer, I'd have to take a little closer look at it. You know, it says a majority of the directors constitutes a quorum. The board of directors, not fewer than five nor more than 11, so I think, you know, the actual number would depend upon how many you got on the board.
But the basic question is, I don't know this wording, because normally I thought even if you took a majority of members of the board present to produce a quorum, you still had a majority of members of the board to pass a motion.
Right.
But the way I read this, it's a majority of the members present and voting pass a motion. So if only six members are present, but six is a quorum, four could pass a motion. So conceivably, you could have four members voting in affirmative on an 11-member board and passing motions.
Well, I guess that might be the case, yes.
Was that the intent?
I'm sorry?
Is that the intent?
Senator Ringo, Senator Beyer, I can't tell you if that was the intent. I mean, the way this is worded, I think Mr. Tuckman, who's going to testify later, could address that. I mean, legal counsel has looked at this. I'm not sure exactly what the intent is. A majority constitutes a quorum, and a majority present can pass a motion. So if you've got five members of the board and three are there, I would presume that three could conduct business.
Okay,
six and four.
I agree with that statement, but would all three have to vote in affirmative then? Or could two of the three then pass a motion?
Well, I would suppose two of the three could pass the motion, yes.
So you set it up so that a minority of a board could pass motions on behalf of the entire board?
That appears to be the way it's written, yes. I can't address the intent question, but yes, that would be my interpretation the way it's written.
But that's my question. Is the intent of this drafting, or is this just a drafting error?
Well, Senator Ringo, Senator Beyer, again, I can't address the intent. I mean, this bill was written such that a majority of the directors constitutes a quorum, and a majority present is sufficient to pass a motion. So I can't address the intent, but I would say that, yes, that is my interpretation.
But, Mr. Chair, Reverend Burley, as author of the bill, would that be where you would want this bill to be drafted, so that a minority member of a board could pass motions on behalf of the entire board?
Well, Senator Ringo, Senator Beyer, when I read it, I didn't have any objections to the way it was written.
Okay. I'll just ask a couple more, Mr. Chair. Under Section 5, the Board of Directors has to have one-third represent conservation interests and one-third represent business interests. Are those defined anywhere, what that means?
No. I'm sorry, Senator Ringo, Senator Beyer, no, it's not defined.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll defer the rest of my questions until later or in private. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, your testimony. Thomas Tuckman, Brad Calfonte. Okay, Bill Cooding, your.
Morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Tuckman. I'm president of U.S. Forest Capital. We're a forestry and financial services company based out of Portland, Oregon, and we help landowners and buyers look at their conservation values and help them work through ways to monetize those and to fix their policy problems. I'm pleased to be here to support House Bill 2729, which creates forest authorities for purposes of large-scale forest land acquisition. I know you have a long day, so I'll just try and give some large or big picture perspective. I think you have some technical questions for us. Changes in the forest products industry have led to 50% change in ownership over the last 10 years throughout this country. In Eastern Oregon, Representative Burley talked about a couple transactions. It's actually been over 1 million acres of working forest lands have changed hands over the last 18 months. In addition to that, the way that these forests are managed, which historically was supply for mills, has changed as well in terms of landowners looking at ways to maximize the return, which is fine, but also is putting pressure on those working forests to have them divided and used for alternative uses. And then thirdly, we continue to have environmental issues and demands for protection of biological diversity, endangered species, recreational opportunities. And while population grows, we have been working with the forest products industry, conservation community, and local opinion leaders to say, hey, if there's a forest that the local community feels is in better use through large-scale working forest versus a smaller fragmented forest, is there a way to finance that acquisition? That's what our bill does. It basically allows a private nonprofit, and to respond to a question earlier, it is private. It's private, period. There is no, if you will, public purpose in the ownership. There is a public purpose in the financing, but there is not a public purpose in the ownership. They may move to or apply to a local forest authority that's been created by the municipality to use either taxable or tax-exempt debt to finance the acquisition of forest. The way the financing works is, in exchange for a lower cost of capital, marginal lower cost of capital, that private nonprofit can borrow the money. They put a forest management plan together. They work through the cash flows like any forest landowner would, do all their due diligence, and they would acquire the property from a willing seller. They would then harvest trees to service their debt and both pay interest and principal on their debt, and after that principal and interest is paid off, they will have excess revenues to provide for public purposes, whether it's education, roads, schools, etc. In essence, that's what our bill does. In other states, I think you asked the question, in other states, they already have authority for these issuing authorities to issue this type of debt. In Oregon, in our consultations with bond counsel, primarily Orrick Herrington Sutcliffe, they said that in Oregon there is not the authority to issue this kind of debt. That's why we're here today, is to get the authority to allow municipalities to create those organizations so that private nonprofits that want to pursue these transactions may do so. I think I'll leave it to that. At that for now, and answer any questions after my colleagues are finished.
Bill, do you want to go first?
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Ringel, committee. For the record, I'm Bill J. Chukling, representing Western Council of Industrial Workers in Oregon. We have over 4,000 members. I want to thank you for bringing House Bill 2729 forward. My members and all and any timber worker, mill worker in this state depends on a dependable supply of timber. We're here to ask you to support House Bill 2729, a bill that would establish the rights of cities or counties to form community forest authorities through which forest lands could be acquired with proceeds from revenue bonds. We support the measure for the following reasons. It provides a tool for communities that desire to keep forest lands in forest use rather than allowing these lands to convert to non-forest uses. Through this authority, these forest lands will provide a sustainable timber harvest to pay off the debt. Sound environmental protections will be built into the forest management plan for clean water, protection of soils, unique plant animal life, and provide recreational uses. Promote a stable, predictable harvest level to support wood products manufacturing jobs in the community. It creates an opportunity for citizens, business people, and worker represent representatives to come together on these forest boards to guide forest management policy for these lands. The concept works on several levels. It maintains needed forest lands, promoting healthy forest environments, and supporting family-raised jobs in rural communities. And the unique part is, once the bonds are paid off, it provides a predictable revenue for city, county, and school budgets. And that's something we don't have today. And this would be done through a sustainable timber harvest. Thank you, and I'll try and answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chalfanti?
Senators, my name is Brad Chalfant. I'm the executive director of the Deschutes Basin Land Trust, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in front of you today. My organization is a private nonprofit. We acquire land. We hold land essentially to keep it open for wildlife habitat, for public recreation, scenic views, and not incidentally for a sustainable local economy. My organization is strongly supportive of House Bill 2729. As was mentioned earlier, we've seen a tremendous change in ownership of private timberlands. In Central Oregon, the fastest growing part of the state of Oregon, that's never been more apparent than in the last couple of years. With Crown Pacific's demise in bankruptcy, we've seen the change of over 300,000 acres in Central Oregon. We're very fearful of what that means, not only for the local wildlife, recreation, but also for the local economy. We're here because we're very interested in trying to pursue transactions. These are not transactions that private timber companies are interested in. These are transactions that have a real value to the local economy, the local community. These are the very special and unique transactions that are critical to the long-term sustainability of our local communities. I think it's probably clear to all of you, but in an Oregon that has changed very rapidly in the last few years, it's not always clear to folks that there are wildlife values on private timberland. These are managed tree farms. What we want to do is keep these in that condition. Once they've been subdivided, once they've been broken up, we lose the wildlife habitat, we lose a sustainable log supply, and we also lose recreation assets that have been very important to the local communities. I'll close and try and answer any questions that you may have, but we strongly feel that this bill will give us an opportunity and a new tool that's critical to the long-term sustainability of our community. Thank you.
Thank you. The Crown Pacific lands that you're talking about, Senator Westland indicated just west of Bend.
Or yes.
Maybe it was the representative who did. Who owns those now?
Those are held by a holding company composed of the secured creditors of Crown Pacific.
I guess is what I'm wondering is, what is the current development potential of those lands? There's no Measure 37 claim because there's a new owner. My understanding is east side, I think it's 360 acres. Is that what it is?
Actually, 240 acres.
Okay, 240 acres. So it can't be subdivided down to 10-acre minimums or, you know, 5-acre minimums. As things currently stand, we're looking at 240-acre minimums. Is it your goal to prevent that?
Yes, it is.
I see. You would say that 240-acre minimum is too intensive and that will interfere with the timber production.
Well, it interferes with not only the timber production, the ability to manage these large tracts economically, but it will also interfere with the ability to maintain a very important herd of mule deer, over 2,200 head of mule deer that ODFW tries to manage for on that ground. It's a critical winter range, and it's a critical part of the hunting opportunities in Central Oregon. I've been told by the wildlife biologists that we lose a tract like this, and we're largely going to lose that as a manageable herd. So it's important for a number of different reasons. Once it's been subdivided, 240 acres is a pretty good size piece of ground, but that's essentially the beginning of a change of those landscapes. It would be one thing if we were seeing folks buying up small tracts of timber and managing them as small tracts of timber, private woodlands. That's not what we're seeing happen. My organization is a member of the Small Woodlands Association. We strongly support the great work that those folks are doing, and we want to encourage long-term stewardship of their lands. The problem is that we're seeing a change in the ownership, folks who know nothing about managing timberlands, and not only do we lose habitat, but we lose all of the other good things that go with these working tree farms.
And if this bill passes, is it your intention to pursue acquisition of the Crown lands?
We are certain. I hate to get into details of specific transactions, but we certainly have an interest in trying to pursue projects in that area.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, first, you said this is not public land, this is private land. Where in this bill is a prohibition against the Forest Authority actually issuing the bonds and buying the land themselves?
The chain, Chairman Ringo, Senator Beyer, that same question came up in the House. We, and I'm not sure which version of the bill you're working off of, but amendments were adopted on the House side that only allowed the Forest Authority to be the issuer of the debt and not the owner of the forest land itself.
Mr. Chair, and I know you probably don't have the bill in front of you. I'm looking at the Angler's version. I can't find anywhere in here, and in fact, it specifically speaks of the assets or portions of the assets owned by the Forest Authority. So I'm wanting to know. When you get a chance to find it, doesn't appear right now. Where in this bill can you show me the prohibition from owning the forest land? Because I don't see it. I couldn't find it as I looked through the bill.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that. That was not the usual purpose. That's not the intent.
Would the Forest Authority have the ability of condemnation?
No, they would not.
And can you show me at some point in time where that is in the bill also?
Yes, it's not in the bill. It's what Senator Beyer. It's not technically in the bill, but the purpose of the to backtrack. This bill was drafted based on the Hospital Authorities Act. It is a permissive bill in the sense that the only activity that authority is allowed to participate in is the issuance of debt. And I can provide you with the legal history and rationale for that.
Thank you, because I don't see what that is in the bill. You also said the land has to be managed to be a commercial productive forest. Where does that say that in the bill?
It's not in the bill. It's in the financing. These are revenue bonds, not general obligation bonds. And so for a private nonprofit to successfully have this debt issued for this purpose, they will have to show that the sustainable harvest of this forest will provide the revenue source for both the debt service and the payment of interest for the acquisition or for that, if you are borrowing.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to, again, you need to show me where it says that, because the way I read Section 8, it says revenue bonds or other revenue obligations. What are other revenue obligations? I'm not expecting you to have to answer them right now, because
okay.
I recognize I'm asking some very technical questions. Section 8 of the bill also speaks of the fact that once the Forest Authority is created, that what they do is not subject to prior approval by the electors of the municipality. So the way I'm reading that is that once a governing body, a county or a city, creates a Forest Authority, that what that Forest Authority does is complete autonomy, and if they are going way left field from what the purpose was, there's nothing the electors of the municipality or the county can do to rein them in.
Chairman Ringo, Senator Beyer, this financing vehicle is a vehicle that allows public purposes to be financed through private investment. The investment here is being made by a private body, not by a public body. The role for the Forest Authority here is simply to give, if you will, a stamp of approval that a public purpose for which that debt is being issued is real. There are a number of different, I'll call them police mechanisms, built into the financings that provide oversight to make sure that public purpose is maintained over time. And this is specific to a question that you had the other day, was the investors, and there's literally could be 1,000 investors in a $50 million deal, they will hire a bond trustee that is responsible for making sure that both the financial covenants are met and the public purpose covenants are met. They're dual covenants, and they're both important. The financial covenants are important because, of course, the investors want to get paid back their principal, and they also want to get paid their interest. The public purpose covenants are important because that lower cost of capital is dependent on them providing that public purpose, which here is defined as renewable commercial forest resource use, community stability, and sound conservation practices. And that's in section 2 of the bill. So if they go, as you suggested, to left field, they lose that tax exempt status, and substantial financial penalties are made on those investors. So these transactions are very, if you will, conservative. I'm not talking politically conservative. They're financially conservative. Bond counsel, who sort of gives their stamp of approval on all these, are personally liable. They are. This is getting back to another question you had. They are not junk bonds. They're rated A or better, which is investment grade analysis, or investment grade rating. So those are a series of if you will, private market police mechanisms that are built into these financings to make sure both the public purpose and the financial covenants are met.
Okay. One final question, and I don't know which of you said it, I don't remember now, but one of you said that we have a high turnover of these commercial forest lands, and no industrial companies are interested in these lands. I guess I'd like to know why there is no industrial company is interested in these lands, and if it's for the reason I think you're going to say is that they aren't being profitable, then how is it you think that a public entity can run them at a profit?
Chairman Ringo, Senator Byer, let me respond to that. I don't think the intent was to say that there are no private interests. In fact, the timberland market right now is very frothy. There's a lot of private investment going after private timberlands. That investment, however, is being focused on highly productive forest lands that will provide those economic returns, both financially, so high site forest lands, and real estate returns. So what's being sort of dropped out, and where we're focusing what we want to do, is on those areas that do not have high timber returns. And so it's not as if this authority would be out there buying all million acres. There might be, I'm throwing out a number, I don't know if this is accurate, there might be 10%, 20% of those properties that don't have a buyer that the private nonprofit can afford to acquire because they have a marginally lower cost of capital. That's the forest land that we're looking to target with these transactions. We're not looking to, and in fact we can't compete with industrial timberland that has high returns.
One final question. Is this bill or this 430 as drafted limited to only east side of the Cascades?
No, it's not.
Okay.
Committee?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your testimony. Is there anybody else who wants to testify? Greg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this very brief. I know you're on a tight timeline here. We testified over in the House. For the record, my name is Greg Knorr. I'm the Government Affairs Manager for a Weyerhaeuser company. We testified in support of this bill on the House side. We support the concept for creating the Community Forest Authority. We hope that this committee decides to pass the bill out with a favorable recommendation. And I'm not going to belabor the issue around the discussion of large forest land ownerships that you've had a pretty thorough conversation on, but I think fundamental to keeping the Oregon forest sector viable is the sustainable private forest land harvest. And I'd just like to cite this example for you. You've probably heard it many times, but we've gone from a historical harvest level in the state of 8 billion board feet to about 4 billion board feet, and all of which now comes from private or non-industrial private and some state forest land harvest. Our federal forests contribute very, very little to Oregon's forest sector as they once did. So what we see here is an opportunity to provide a financial mechanism like the Forest Authority, Community Forest Authority, that may be used to maintain large block forest lands ownership and contribute to the sustainable harvest level. And that seems like a fairly common sense approach. We have a fairly active, as Weyerhaeuser Company, a very active land acquisition and disposal program. And we do that to strategically fit our facilities in the states that we operate in. You heard a little bit about the example of this effort up in Washington, and Representative Burley accurately described why it didn't go through relative to taxable versus non-taxable bonds. But we think that having a financial instrument such as this, an option like this, as the Community Forest Authority, may increase the number of potential buyers, and it's always good when you're out selling forest land to have as many buyers as possible and then looking at your operations. So with that, I'll close my comments and answer any questions that you might have. I'm not a technical expert on this, but just to support the concept.
Thank you. Do you have a position on Senate Bill 1061?
No, we don't have a position on that bill.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Okay, thanks. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Anybody else want to testify on either House Bill 2729 or Senate Bill 1061? Let's close the public hearing on those bills. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3349. I understand some amendments are in the works, but Dave Honeycutt, do you want to? Is there anybody else who wants to testify on House Bill 3349?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. I was just going to say I think Don Schellenberg is gone, but here he is standing or sitting next to me. This is a Farm Bureau bill, so now that Don's here, I suppose we ought to let Mr. Schellenberg go first with the permission of the chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg representing Oregon Farm Bureau. The purpose of the bill here today is really quite simple. In the EFU zone, you have what's called farm use assessment, and I briefly recounted what farm use assessment was for you the other day. I'll not go through that again. The concern is that under Measure 37, an EFU zone could be disqualified when it allows, because of a Measure 37 claim, allows a non-farm use that state law doesn't allow. What the purpose of the bill is and what the bill says is that nevertheless, a Measure 37 claim does not disqualify an EFU zone for farm use assessment. If that were to happen, it would require paperwork by every year by the producers as well as the assessor's office. Neither of that is necessary, and so we're asking that you send the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I would also suggest to you that Senator Westland does have an amendment that he would like to add to this bill. The amendment was not correctly drafted, and so would ask the chair actually to carry this bill over to Thursday when we can have the correct amendments.
All right. Yes, Senator Byer, I'm sorry.
Is the dash 3 the amendment you were speaking of?
Yes.
And it's a gut stuff?
Well, we just got the dash 3 amendments about 5 seconds ago, and frankly,
is it a gut stuff?
No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, it's not a gut stuff. What the Dash 3s are intended to do is to provide for veterans centers and add that to this bill. The bill has somewhat of a wide relating clause that allows them to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the Dash 3s, I just read the Dash 3s, they are a gut and stuff, and that wasn't, I don't think that's the intent of Senator Westland. We like the bill, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, we like the bill as written, and there was no opposition to the bill on the other side. The testimony was the department, BLCD, Don, and myself. We wouldn't support a gut and stuff on this bill. Stuff would, if there's no objection to adding things to it, that'd be fine, but we like the bill. We like 3349 as it currently is.
So it would be safe to assume that the Oregon Farm Bureau and Oregon's Action would both be opposed to the Dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, yes.
We
would be opposed to the Dash 3 amendments.
Who prepared the Dash 3 amendments? Senator Westland?
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland prepared the Dash 3 amendments. They were not drafted to his specifications, and so he's having those corrected. But those won't be ready today. All right. I want to just let this bill mellow anyway. So let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3349. Let's roll over a few bills to next time. Which ones do we want to roll over till next time?
Mr. Chairman, the list I had was Senate Bill 699, Senate Bill 532, House Joint Memorial 5, House Bill 2258, House Bill 2755, House Bill 2881, and House Bill 3349.
Which is essentially everything except for 347 that we didn't get to today.
All right. Well, the bills that were just read are rolled over to the next regularly scheduled meeting, and this hearing is adjourned.